Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Veterans Affairs on Capitol Hill, Antarctic meltdown, Turkey's disaster, India's vote, Karl Rove and Hillary Clinton, D.C. hearings on delayed care, false records, dead vets. Republican Nevada Senator Dean Heller took on VA Chief Eric Shinseki.
Could you explain to me, after knowing all this information, why you should not resign?
Well, I tell you, Senator, that I came here to make things better for veterans.
Karl Rove on Hillary Clinton's health, brain injury, he said. Bill Clinton called it politics.
First they said she faked her concussion, and now they say she's auditioning for a part on The Walking Dead.
And 280-plus dead in Turkey in a coal mine explosion. Outraged citizens turned on Turkey's prime minister, mobbing, pummeling his car. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, Miriam Elder of BuzzFeed, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see this week in polar ice melt, Karl Rove, India, Michael Sam? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington with a big eye on the country is John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. John McCormick, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Miriam Elder joins us with an eye on the whole world, foreign editor at BuzzFeed, formerly Moscow correspondent for The Guardian. Miriam Elder, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, John, and Miriam.
Let's go straight to the VA hearings yesterday. Eric Shinseki, very uncomfortable there. Nobody would be comfortable with these findings that have come out in press reports. Here's Vermont Democrat Bernie Sanders, chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, asking about the extent of these allegations. Shinseki downplaying the scope.
Are people, quote unquote, cooking the books?
I'm not aware, and other than a number of isolated cases where there is evidence of that.
Yeah, well, still, we've all heard about where there is evidence, and it seems that it's quite a number of places at this point. Senator Richard Byrd, North Carolina Republican, said wait times for veterans at VA hospitals are not a new problem, that Secretary Shinseki should have addressed the issue by now.
VA senior leadership, including the secretary, should have been aware that VA was facing a national scheduling crisis. VA's leadership has either failed to connect the dots or failed to address this ongoing crisis, which has resulted in patient harm and in patient death.
John McCormick, what's your sense of the hearings yesterday, the sense on Capitol Hill? Will Eric Shinseki hang on to his seat? He says, look, I'm working hard. We've made progress, but these reports are pretty damning. What are his prospects?
The hearing did not go well. You know, he said he was mad as hell about these allegations. But when asked about, well, what's actually going to happen? What would happen, you know, if these people are, what are you going to do? And he kind of said, well, we're basically sitting on our hands until the Veterans Affairs Inspector General releases his report. And even a Democrat Senator, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, said, well, why are you waiting for the VA Inspector General? Why don't you call more resources? You can call on the FBI or different agencies. I mean, we're talking about criminal wrongdoing here. People lying, falsifying records, a secret waiting list, and where up to 40 veterans might have died in one location alone in Phoenix. We've had reports that this has spread to Cheyenne, in Texas, in Georgia. There have been reports about delays and mm-hmm. harm done to veterans there. So it was really troubling. I thought it was even more jaw-dropping when the Undersecretary of Health, testifying alongside General Shinseki, was asked, well, what would happen if we discovered that there was manipulation of these waiting lists? And would that person be fired? And he said, I'm not sure whether or not that would be the appropriate punishment. So it was just really, you know, really an unimpressive performance. It didn't inspire a lot of confidence that they know what's going on. There were references to memos from as far back as 2010, where they had laid out, you know, the VA internal memo had discovered all these different ways that different VA officials were cooking the books. They were, you know, had a secret waiting list, you know, one in one online in the electronic records, another one, the real one on paper, where people were not getting care for weeks and sometimes dying while waiting for care. So it was a really troubling hearing. The more we learn about this, and, you know, there's so much phony outrage in politics, this is just one that is genuinely, genuinely outrageous.
No question.
Did not look good for Shinseki.
You know, John, it's interesting, though. I mean, it's really appalling to read some of these things. Mm-hmm. And yet, when we open the phone lines here, which we have done, lots of vets also call in saying, oh, I get great service from my VA hospital. It's hard to figure out exactly where this lands. Miriam Elder, you watch countries all over the world. What do you make of this American spectacle, sort of going after ourselves on our treatment of our veterans?
Well, I think it's something that's going to come up more and more as the war is winding down in Afghanistan and we have ever more veterans coming home. It seems like there's just a shift going to the troops that have served out there rather than the attention being on what's happening on the ground. And it's sort of horrific. And one story that we had this week was that a Veteran Affairs group is setting up a whistleblowing program and trying to encourage Veterans Affairs employees to expose any wrongdoing that they see. So to, you know, avoid having to go through the leadership or straight to the press and just kind of make sure that these allegations can become public as soon as possible, so some sort of change or outrage can come from it.
Jack, I'll come to you right away on this, but a couple of callers first. Waterford, Pennsylvania, Dolores is on the air. Hi, Dolores, you're with us. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Hi. First of all, I'm retired Army.
Yeah.
I also worked for the VA in the early 80s.
Okay.
My husband, Vietnam veteran, served in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive and just recently retired from the VA himself as an employee. I have received care at three VA hospitals, Erie, Pennsylvania, that's my primary facility, Buffalo, New York, Pittsburgh.
Dolores, what's your bottom line here? Take us to it.
Bottom line is there is no, I have received excellent care from the VA, always. I have never had problems with appointments. Same with my husband. We have a lot of friends.
You worked there. So did he. Are you just defending your own performance?
No, I mean, people have no idea. If you go into one of these VA hospitals, into these regional offices where they process the claims, I mean, you are inundated with tremendous amount of paper. You have people coming in. They're getting, you know, service-connected for acne, service-connected for hysterectomies, never seen combat getting 100% for paranoid schizophrenia. The woman who's writing in and saying, well, my brother was in Korea. He busted up my phone. Now the VA, or busted up my stove. Now the VA owes me a new stove. I mean, people have no idea.
The volume and how it sprawls. Dolores, I appreciate your call. And one more, Buffalo, New York. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. This is an issue I feel really passionate about. I have been a provider in the VA system, both as a nurse and as a psychiatric behavioral health.
Okay.
The problem that we often encountered was the volume and that we weren't able to adequately provide for those veterans in our clinics. It was overtaxed, trying to see vets within 14 days, and then once seeing them, not having any place to send them because our panels were so heavily booked that we couldn't see these veterans back in a timely fashion, specifically addressing those with PTSD.
Robin, let me pick it up right there, if I may, and I appreciate your call from Buffalo. Jack, we opened the phone lines and boom, right there, two calls, and they're both about the volume of need, the volume of demands.
Yes, and, you know, last year, John Stewart, who's, I think, an incomparable moralist on this, showed a stills of a room, a fire, you know, an office in, I think, Carolina, one of the Carolinas, with documents going to the ceiling such that they were health hazards, and those were backlog records. And the point he made was, and of course the VA has made progress on that, but the point he made was contrast this to, and then he went on, the care the Obama campaign took with its electronic monitoring of voters, the resources devoted to getting out the vote, the, you know, the permutations that were conducted and assessed in order to make sure every last demographic who could vote for Obama did. And he said, look, here's the attention the president gave to his own reelection, and here's this room, the attention that he's given to this disgrace. And, you know, that may not be entirely fair, but there is a broad truth in that. We all know this has been going on for years. There has to be a resource problem there. There has to be a systemic problem when one reads that these hospitals, part of the reason they're having these two lists is an incentive system from Washington that gives them bonuses.
all of this makes it looks awfully bad when you set against the high-tech performance of the Obama campaign.
We mentioned Senator Sanders there, independent, of course, from Vermont. But what's your bottom line, Jack? Should Shinseki go then? Sounds like a management problem in part. Should he go?
It seems to me he has to go. I mean, that was a disastrous performance yesterday. He said, I'm mad as hell, the way you might say, oh, man, am I tired. I mean, he's not
a real demonstrative guy. That doesn't mean he's a bad guy.
No, but leadership is partly galvanizing your organization to act. This man is a stranger to that.
John McCormick, is it possible that we just cannot afford the back end of our own wars?
I mean, I think anyone, we have to, I mean, even the wars we've already fought, we need to care for those veterans. And I think, you know, the question you asked earlier about how do we reconcile reports of good care with all these problems, I mean, I think that's endemic to, a closed government-run system. I mean, the NHS in Britain, you can get good care. It's a question of whether or not you get that care. There are waiting lists inherent. And any time that you have, government-run, government-funded, you don't have a market mechanism where you can compete and fire your doctor. You're just stuck in the system waiting for a bureaucrat.
You think our vets would be better off out in our private healthcare system in this country?
I think they should have gold-plated healthcare, the best private health plan you can imagine. They should have a choice to go to whatever hospital they want. I think that we, and whatever it costs, we should pay that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the VA under fire, Antarctic meltdown, India's vote, Karl Rove goes after Hillary Clinton, top woman out at the New York Times with Miriam Elder, foreign editor at BuzzFeed, John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, Jack Beatty's here as well. We asked our listeners what their top stories were this week, and the first ones that flooded in were climate change and net neutrality. There's a lot to look at, but let's look at those. New study out just this week by NASA and the University of California, Irvine, found that the West Antarctic ice sheet is, the study said, in a rapid state of melting. Worse, lead researcher of the study, Eric Rigno, says this melting cannot, at this point, be stopped. Here he is narrating an animation of the future of that Antarctic melt.
There is no mountain or big hill along the way that could act as a barrier to hold these glaciers back. The glaciers speed up, the grounding line retreat, the deep valleys that are sloping inland, all reinforce each other to make the retreat of ice in this part of Antarctica unstoppable. And we think that this is what is happening right now.
We've got science there. We've got politics as well. It just happened this week on ABC's This Week. Florida Senator Marco Rubio drew attention when he said he believed in climate change but doesn't think humans are the cause.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it. That's what I do not, and I do not believe that the laws that they propose we pass will do anything about it, except it will destroy our economy.
Miriam Elder, first to you. There's the economy, there's the planet. I mean, worldwide, are people watching these reports? Do they see these sea level rises coming, calculating for their cities and, you know, whether it's in the U.S. or you name it, what the future looks like?
Well, I think climate change has been an issue abroad for a lot longer than it has been here in the United States. It's taken a lot more seriously in Europe, in the Middle East, and basically everywhere except for here. And I thought this report was utterly terrifying. And the question now is exactly what you posed, which is how do we prepare for this? The changes that we can see around the planet as a result of this sheet melting can change the entire way that populations are positioned around the world and can lead to a whole lot of chaos.
John McCormick, what do you see in the American response? In, let's say, Marco Rubio, this was before this report came out, but he's been talking about it all week because people keep asking him. In what we've done so far, in what we're likely to do as a country to prepare or try to prevent some portion of what's to come.
Mm-hmm. I think what was key in Rubio's statement was, I don't believe that human activity is causing it in the way some of these scientists say it is, and I don't believe that the response is enough to fix it. I mean, if it's a global problem, it requires a global response. So I think that both of those things are defensible. But I mean, look back to when Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate. They had a huge, huge majority in the House of Representatives. They passed cap and trade in the House, and it didn't even come up for a vote in the Senate. So what I don't think that there's a political will right now. I mean, you don't even have when the Democrats have a supermajority, you haven't had the will to bring about something. And I think it's offensible in saying that cap and trade is not going to solve global warming. This is a huge if what the scientists who have argued in favor of this proposal are saying is true, then I don't think the cap and trade is enough. So the question is whether we're willing to pay the huge economic price for trying to stop something that may be unstoppable.
Jack, are we going to just sit here and fry and drown? Because otherwise we would hurt the economy. The economy surely won't be too good in that situation.
You know, the question is, can our planet survive our politics? You have to wonder. I mean, with Senator Rubio, it was pretty clear that he was, posing or running in what people call the Koch brothers primary, the sort of Tea Party primary. Because if you look at the polls, 61% of Republicans, according to a Pew poll last year, believe that climate change is real and man-driven, but only 25% of Tea Party people. So there's this huge gap within the Republican ranks. And when you get to the general electorate, there's overwhelming belief, or at least well above 60%, that it's happening, that it's man-made. And when you look at suggested nostrums, like the limitation on stricter limits on emissions from power plants, which is coming up next month from the Obama administration, two-thirds of Americans are in favor of that. And in order to get right with the Tea Party people, Senator Rubio and I suspect other candidates will be tempted to go in this direction, which puts them somewhat, if not dramatically, at variance with the general electorate in a November election.
We had, of course, this issue in some part on Capitol Hill this week with the Senate. There was a big package, bipartisan, Republican and Democrat, to cut back on federal energy use. It went down in a complicated bunch of maneuvers there. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid blamed Republicans for rejection of the bipartisan bill that would promote energy efficiency and likely would have led to more debate over the Keystone XL pipeline.
Look at how Republican obstruction is bringing the Senate to its knees again and again and again. And now even on this bill, a bipartisan bill.
Of course, speaking with NPR's Alyssa Chang on Monday, John McCain of Arizona defended his Republican colleagues, blamed Reid.
The dictator won't allow us to have any amendments. I mean, it is just unprecedented. I've been around here a long, long time.
John McCormick, people say this was a pretty modest bill to cut back on federal energy consumption and bring in some bipartisan measures to make a more sensible policy there. Why it's flaming failure?
Well, as McCain said, on both sides, you've had Democrats come out and say they don't like the way Reid's running the Senate, that he won't allow any debate, he won't allow amendments. There has been a process in place where senators are supposed to have the prerogative to at least offer a few amendments, at least bring it up for a vote. The Senate is not supposed to be like the House, which is kind of run with an iron fist. The Senate is supposed to be the world's greatest deliberative body, and Reid has decided to turn the Senate into the House, and Republicans have said, listen, if you're not going to give us at least one or two or three amendments, we're going to block this. And so you can say it's childish, but that's how politics is going these days.
But what about just everybody holding their guns on the big issues just to get this modest thing through around federal government? I mean, what happened to the days when we could separate the doable from the implacably opposed and get something done, John?
That's a fair point.
Jack, what do you see in this unfolding legislative dance this week there?
Well, you know, to have this bill die, as you say, 3 years in the making, bipartisan, would have passed in the House. To have this bill die the same week that Miami got the bad news that it would be underwater in 200 years, I mean, it just makes you think there's no hope. And all of this for the shortest term political gain. The Democrats wanted some senators to be not to take a tough vote on the Keystone Pipeline. The Republicans wanted those same senators to take a tough vote on one of their amendments. And the result was neither party could move. The Senate was, you can ask yourself, what's more frozen, the Antarctica's glaciers or the Senate? And the Senate by a long shot.
Let's look at politics on the other side of the world for just a second here. Big country, India, big elections went on for 5 weeks. At the end of that, the Congress Party, which has been in power for a long, long time, is on its way out. Narendra Modi with the BJP on his way in. Here's supporters cheering his name at a victory rally today. Modi, Modi, Modi. Miriam Elder, it can seem an awfully long way off. What's it mean for India in a nutshell? What might it mean for the region? We're there in Afghanistan, for the U.S. more broadly.
Well, what's interesting is just before I started speaking with you, saw that Afghanistan had already congratulated Modi on his victory. We'll see what it means in the future, but it's a major thing for India. This is he won by a landslide. You had young people especially participating in numbers that you haven't seen them participate in Indian politics before. This was an extremely, extremely lively campaign. And I think that there's equal parts hope that he can kind of change the course that the country is on and particularly pay attention to things like the economy and crack down on things like corruption. But there are also a lot of concerns that he has sort of tendencies towards a bizarre cult of personality. We saw him deploying, you know, holograms of himself during the campaign.
Hey, everybody has their own politics. Ours can get pretty weird, too. What about the Hindu nationalist face of this party? Is that a big deal? Is it as if a, I don't know, Christian nationalist party came to power here or an Islamic nationalist party? Does that portend cultural conflict in India? Or not. They've got a big Muslim population.
Right. I mean, that's the question. It seems like he did get kind of a broad swath of the vote. And the fact that he oversaw, you know, the region where the Gujarat riots took place, where over 1,000 people were killed about a decade ago, the fact that it didn't come up in the election is sort of interesting. And we'll have to see if it rears its head and what happens going forward. But I think right now he wasn't elected necessarily on a Hindu nationalist platform, but more on a we're going to change this country kind of platform.
We've got politics abroad, politics at home. Dan in Cleveland, Ohio. Dan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I wanted to make a little comment about Bill Clinton's interview yesterday. He was responding to Mr. Rhodes, and he said something about Hillary's memory may be going or something. And Bill responded, he said, "You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with her memory. I've been trying to get her to answer me about Whitewater for years, and she just doesn't."
What?
So I think the thing is, when a person doesn't want to answer a question, they, in politics, seem to sidestep it. And I think that's just politics.
Of course, there's the question of whether it should be a question. Karl Rove said this week it should. He used the phrase brain injury. New York papers got on that. New York Post, it became brain damage, and that was all over the place. Karl Rove walking back on that, but yet the issue out there in public, here he is talking about his comments.
My point was that Hillary Clinton wants to run for president, but she would not be human if this didn't enter in as a consideration. And my other point is this will be an issue in the 2016 races, whether she likes it or not.
Well, it's an issue already the way it's come out. Newt Gingrich, among others, saying this is bad, saying he was deeply offended by Rove's comments, saying this is everything that's wrong with American politics. Here was Gingrich on CNN's Crossfire on Monday.
This is an absurdity, and it typifies the Republican consulting class, which wants to be negative, narrow, personal, avoid ideas, and not have to wrestle with the big issues.
And yes, Bill Clinton was out there in defense of his wife. Here he was on Wednesday.
She works out every week. She is strong. She's doing great. As far as I can tell, she's in better shape than I am. She certainly seems to have more stamina now. And there's nothing to it.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of Karl Rove's, I'm not sure what to call this, his comments? Is this a strategic injection of an issue? Is it a fair comment on health in advance of a front runner's announcement? How do you see it?
Well, it certainly looks like a smear, doesn't it? I mean, that is to say, there's no foundation that anyone can find for it. In fact, yes, she did suffer an injury, but the conjecture about, at least the conjecture attributed to Rove about her, you know, brain damage, that seems to be in the classification of the thing that Rove really rose on, which is rumor.
Fairness, that language was not his; it was the New York Post. He said traumatic brain injury, which she had a concussion. She was in the hospital for that. That's technically a brain injury. But maybe he knew that if he put it out there that way, it would turn into brain damage. I don't know.
Well, we don't know, and we write we should be careful. But you know what we know about Rove's judgment? On Fox News on election night, he dismissed the evidence that President Obama had won. At the moment, President Obama won. If chances are strong that he's wrong when he speaks about politics, what about neurology? You know, you wonder, somebody's brain is damaged, and it's not Hillary's. And the strange thing is, this week, too, Hillary, in some Republican quarters, Louis Gohmert in the House of Representatives, people on Fox, Hillary was blamed for Boko Haram's kidnapping of the Nigerian girls. How is that? Well, when she was Secretary of State, she didn't classify the group as a terrorist organization. organization. Why? Didn't want to give it the visibility. Since then, it has been so classified. That didn't prevent the kidnapping. But so lurid are these charges that have dogged Hillary and that surround her. Remember from the 90s when, you know, the Wall Street Journal was running editorials about insinuating that somehow she was involved in the murder of one of her aides. This sort of thing, I think we're going to hear more and more of with Mrs. Clinton as a candidate.
Here just a little bit from the taping of Barbara Walters' final episode of The View airing today. Walters asks Hillary Clinton about her plans for the 2016 presidential election.
The question I want to ask is, are you going to run? But
well, I am running around the park.
Around the park. She's active. John McCormick, Karl Rove, out of bounds here? Newt Gingrich says so or not, John?
I mean, I think it depends on the way he framed it. I mean, the question of a candidate's age has always come up, and usually against Republicans. And some Republicans have been able to deflect it, like Ronald Reagan, who famously quipped in 1984 that he wasn't going to let his opponent's youth and inexperience be an issue in the race, and really charmed everyone. Go back to 1995. There is a Time magazine cover story with a picture of Bob Dole. Is Dole too old for the job? Question mark. John McCain in 2008. There were lots of insinuations that every time he misspoke that, oh, maybe his mind's going. He's kind of an old doddering man who doesn't know what's going on. I think the question more is, I mean, Clinton is going to have to release her medical records. As long as she does that, I don't think that this fall, she was in the hospital for 3 days, not 30, as Rove supposedly said. He disputes that, but he should be accurate about this. I mean, it was a serious issue with a blood clot, but these things are treatable. And as long as, I mean, she appears, very much with it. So as long as she releases her medical records, and more importantly, that she has a forward-looking agenda. You know, the problem with the easier attack against her is that, oh, it's more of the same. It's going back to the past, like Obama said in 2008. Do you want change or do you want more of the same? And so it's just a question of whether she can give a forward-looking agenda, a youthful agenda. She doesn't have to personally be young to do that. But age has frequently been an issue in political elections, and it just depends on whether it becomes something that they can overcome.
Ronald Reagan came right back on that. Miriam Elder, what do you see here? Dirty American politics or par for the global course?
No, it's utterly ridiculous. As someone who spent a lot of time abroad and reporting abroad, to come back to American politics, and these are the sorts of things that people are discussing literally 24 hours a day when the election is just so far off. And obviously her age will come up. Age does always come up. But I don't really think that these comments deserve the attention that they're getting.
Hey, take us for a minute to Syria. We've got the UN's Lakshar Brahimi stepping out of that, saying, I can't do it. Maybe somebody else can, the special representative there. Does that mean endless war in Syria? Is that the prospect?
That is the prospect, but it's not because he's stepping down. It's been a horrific war for 3 years. The global community, frankly, doesn't really care. The United States has taken itself out of it entirely. Russia is kind of running the show, and that's a decision that was made quite a while ago. This is just another tragic step in a very, very tragic war.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, former Army Sergeant Kyle White received the Medal of Honor. In 2007, the 20-year-old risked his own life, again and again, trying to save fellow soldiers in a brutal Afghan firefight. Real heroism. He was modest.
I just was literally doing the job I was trained to do. And I know that any of those guys there that day, they would have done the exact same thing.
In Saturday's NFL draft, with 249th pick on the line, the St. Louis Rams selected Michael Sam. Now the first openly gay man in professional football, he shed tears and shared a very public kiss with his boyfriend.
I have every confidence in myself that I will make this team. So when I do make it, and when I put my pads on, and if somebody wants to say something, then you will see number 96 running down that field and making big plays.
And legendary newscaster Barbara Walters signs off today. On Wednesday, she shared a moment with another soon-to-be retiree, David Letterman.
Let's walk into the sunset together.
Okay, that's fine. We'll do that.
Oh.
Wait a minute. I think we just made a suicide pact.
Barbara Walters, you first to David Letterman. We're looking at a week in the news with Miriam Elder of BuzzFeed, foreign editor there. John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Our own Jack Beatty. We mentioned Lakhdar Brahimi headed out as UN envoy to Syria with sadness. Here he was.
It's very sad that I leave this position and leave Syria behind.
in such a bad state.
And right next door in Turkey, big mining disaster, almost 300 feared dead there. Speaking in the town of Soma in Turkey on Wednesday, near the site of the mining disaster, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that the inspired protests with what critics called insensitive comments on the tragedy, such as this one, that the mining accidents, he said, are ordinary things. Here he is interpreted by the AP.
Such mine accidents don't only happen in Turkey. They also happen in many countries, such as the United States, China, France, India, and Belgium. Many people died in such coal mine accidents. Our country is in a much better position.
Mary Milder explained this to us. The next thing we saw was his car being absolutely pummeled and mobbed by really angry Turks. There seems to be a lot boiling here. I mean, the disaster is bad enough, but what's the tension running through Turkish politics that has things at such a fever pitch there beyond the deaths, which are terrible, Miriam?
Right. Aside from the tragedy, I mean, basically what's happened is Erdogan has been becoming more and more authoritarian. We've seen it a particularly sharp increase in that in just the past few months. He's cracking down on freedom of expression, on freedom of assembly. There's ever more corruption scandals coming up around him. And we've seen protests mainly in Istanbul for more than a year now. That's mainly like the urban middle class. But mm-hmm. I think what's happening now is that discontent is spreading to what he once saw as his base, which is people who tend to be, you know, more in the countryside. And he's set to step down as prime minister pretty soon. And everyone's expecting him to then run for president, another authoritarian tendency where, you know, he'll just kind of move from one position to the other and then empower the presidency. So this is this poses a really huge threat for his political future.
Comments online here on Marco Rubio. Carl says his comments are a way to keep the same denial of climate change out there without appearing ignorant. Michael says Shinseki should stay. I have to say, lots of comments defending the VA. It's interesting online here. People asking about Iran as well. Those talks back up in gear this week on Iran's nuclear program in Vienna. What prospects there, Miriam?
Everything seems to be on track, and everybody's kind of waiting for the six-month interim deal deadline to run out, which I think happens next month. These are sort of formulaic talks to move towards a more permanent agreement. But everything seems to be going as it is.
What do you mean by everything on track? At the end of that track, isn't there a pretty big question to be resolved about how much they're going to give up? I mean, do we really have steps toward a solution here, or is this killing time before we get back into a standoff?
No, I think that a political decision was made on both sides, both by the Obama administration, and you had, you know, Congress kind of falling into step with that at the end of the day after at first, you know, showing quite a bit of opposition. And the same thing in Iran. There's a lot of political will there with the new administration of Hassan Rouhani. So as long as you have the political will on both sides, it's the two sides coming together to kind of, excuse me, hash out the details going forward.
John McCormick, how do you see the prospects for the Iran nuclear talks?
I'm skeptical, but we'll have to wait and see. I think that it's unlikely that they're actually going to give up their pursuit of nuclear weapons.
Jack?
Yeah, you know, when you look at the gap between what the two sides want, Iran, according to the Financial Times, has 19,000 centrifuges now, and the West wants them to come down just to a few thousand. Iran says, no, we want to go up to 30,000. So they're going in different directions on the nuclear infrastructure. So that's a big, big problem right there that they're facing in these negotiations.
Net neutrality, the Federal Communications Commission, with a 3-2 vote this week to go ahead inviting public comment on a set of rules for the Internet. The chairman, Tom Wheeler, has said this is the way to have an open Internet. Critics have been very harsh on this, saying we're going to get an Internet with two speeds, one for the big and rich, another for the new or poor. Here's Commission Chairman Wheeler yesterday.
The commission has grappled with this issue for more than a decade. Today we took a big step forward. I want to emphasize it's a first step. What we just approved is an opening proposal, not a final rule.
There were protests around the country. There was a little bit of protest right there at that press conference.
I grew up on a free and open Internet. We want to
please, we're trying to move ahead.
A protester there calling for free and open Internet. John in Chicago is calling. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to call and let you guys know that there shouldn't be any censorship online. I think that's one of our last standing points of complete freedom, If somebody can go online and say that they love Jesus, somebody else can go online and say that they love Satan. That being said, you shouldn't limit your data connection. Nobody should, none of these companies should be restricting higher usage just because you can pay more money. I understand it from a business perspective and from a marketing perspective. Yeah, it's the only way the company can make more money. But look at yourself. It's ridiculous. Treat everybody equally. That's what our founding fathers would have wanted if our founding fathers were here for the age of the Internet. They would have wanted equality. They would have wanted neutrality. This is ridiculous, and it's getting out of hand.
John in Chicago, we've got it. I appreciate your call. John McCormick, we had the three Democrats on the FCC panel there voting for this, the two Republicans not, but then they wanted perhaps even less control on who could buy what access, as I understand it, on the web. Where do you see us headed here, John? The web was seen as a realm for innovation because anybody could come in and compete with anybody else. Anybody could afford to get their message out there at you know, more or less comparable speed to the biggest guys. Where are we headed with this ruling?
I don't know, and I think it's a very interesting issue, and I don't really have a firm opinion on it. I mean, on one hand, when you use more of something, when you consume more of something, usually you're expected to pay more. You know, people, you know, the people selling gas-guzzling SUVs aren't expected that their people are going to pay the same for gas as someone driving a hybrid. On the other hand, it does present some interesting issues. I mean, what if the New York Times website can load 10 or 100 times faster than the NPR website? Well, that doesn't seem very fair. I think that, you know, people should be able to get their opinion out there, but I guess there are more difficult issues where you've got something like Netflix streaming huge amounts of data, or Amazon. You know, it comes into, you know, online shopping places too. You know, are we going to give a leg up to the big corporations over the small mom and pop shop? I guess the question is how. There are a lot of questions I think we need to ask before we change things. How big is the differential going to be in terms of speeds? How much is it going to cost to get up to the higher speeds? So some really interesting questions here.
Tom Wheeler, with a big background as a lobbyist in the cable industry, people are going to be watching this one very closely as it rolls forward. You mentioned the New York Times. Very interesting situation there this week. Jill Abramson out as executive editor-in-chief, essentially. First woman editor out at the top of the Times. First African-American editor-in-chief, Dean Baquet, in. Miriam Elder, the talk that came out, a number of things, you know, okay, she's brusque or she's this or she's that. Lots of leaders can be characterized in lots of ways. But also that the word that came out was that she found she had not been paid comparably to her predecessors in that seat. How's that resonating in your neck of the woods, Miriam?
You mean as a woman journalist?
I guess so, yeah.
Well, I think that both of those points are equally important. First of all, a male editor would never be called out for being brusque. He would be expected to be brusque. He would be expected to be pushy. He would be expected to stand up for himself and for his newsroom and for his writers.
Though in fairness, it's not anything goes. I mean, Hal Raines was editor there. You know, he didn't last so very long, in part because of his style. Maybe brusqueness wasn't the issue. I don't know. But he left.
Right, but brusqueness was not the issue, and he was not characterized, from my memory of the reporting at the time, he was not characterized the way that Jill Abramson is being characterized. The pay issue is, of course, also incredibly infuriating. If you believe the details that came out in the New Yorker article reported by Ken Auletta last night, that Jill Abramson found out that she was making even $100,000 less when she was the D.C. bureau chief, $100,000 less than her predecessor. I mean, this is something that's systemic. It's something that we see across journalism, that we see across all fields. Men make more money than women, and I have no idea why.
Jack Beatty, as women get up in higher and more powerful positions and, you know, have the power to kind of open up the cans of worms and look inside, I have a feeling this is not the last time we're going to hear this complaint.
That's for sure. I mean, Heather Bresch, the CEO of the pharmaceutical company Mylan, well, it came out when she got that job that she was making about a third less than the average CEO in her sector. And the new CEO of Campbell's Soup, Denise Morrison, making about a quarter less. And we learned this year about Mary Barra, the first female CEO of General Motors. She's being paid, what is it now, $2.8 million compared to her male predecessor's $7.3 million. Yeah, publicity does seem to be an enemy here of the systemic inequality that has at the highest level, and the S&P 500 has women executives earning 18% less than those in similar men in similar roles.
All those tensions there, and I'm sure it doesn't help John McCormick that all newspapers, Times included, still under a lot of pressure here. Just their basic business model, by no means with the clear sailing ahead.
There were a lot of clashes about that, whether, you know, the business side would have too much control in the editorial process. And there's a lot of, you know, he said, she said, back and forth here. We don't know. These are all rumors as to whether or not, you know, what was she paid? Is that including, you know, Sulzberger comes back, the owner says that it involved the pension because, you know, Bill Keller, her predecessor, had been on longer, so his pension package was bigger. The other side responds saying, no, that's not true. I mean, when someone starts a new job, they don't necessarily in their first year as executive editor, you wouldn't necessarily expect to be paid what the person in their fourth year or fifth year as executive editor was getting paid. But if it is true that she was paid less than her deputy, now that is pretty clear evidence of sexism, I would say. But again, I just don't know which of these allegations are true. I think that everyone in the situation has come across looking incredibly childish and petty. The way that this was handled, there are reports that her successor, Dean Becquet, I don't know how to pronounce his last
Becquet,
name.
Yeah.
Becquet. He slammed his fist against the wall when Jill Abramson had criticized him. And that's not how you behave. And
reportedly threatened to leave. They didn't want him out of there.
I can't verify these. This is all of that report in The New Yorker. So whether it's true or not, I don't know.
We'll no doubt learn a lot more when it comes to journalistic circles. People do tend to write. Mm-hmm. Where? Google. In Europe, and this ruling, Miriam, about a right to forget that Google is now going to have to take down or make inaccessible facts about people that may be uncomfortable for them years down the road. How's that fit into a freedom of information picture? Or does Europe just look at it differently, Miriam?
Well, I think that, Europe has always tended, you know, for its own historical reasons, to value privacy over freedom of speech in general, more than we do here in the U.S. But this was such an interesting case. And I don't know, I kind of see it in the same context as the FCC stuff, the net neutrality stuff, because it just seems like policy is trying to catch up with technology. Whether we talk about, you know, what the NSA is doing with the internet, whether we talk about net neutrality, we just see these cases happening, you know, in the U.S. and all over the world. I think the European ruling is kind of disturbing because who gets to decide? Then it's just always kind of disturbing when you have a government or a supranational government deciding what belongs on the internet and what doesn't. And who gets to decide, you know, what they want to delete or not? What if somebody has something in their history that, of course, they don't want the rest of the world to know, but maybe is in the public service that it should be known?
Yeah, and one can easily imagine that the powerful being especially effective at expunging the tricky stuff there. Pete in Nashville. Pete, thanks for calling. Our time is short. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to comment on Michael Sam. I've been really heartened by his whole story, and I was glad he was drafted. But I think he made a really poor choice in immediately signing on to do a reality show or a documentary series, as they say, because his whole case has been, look at me, I'm just an excellent football player. Judge me on that. I just want to make the team. And now that seems to be going against that. And I don't think it's going to win him any friends in that locker room to begin.
Yeah, I wonder, really, this is on Oprah Winfrey's network, a reality TV documentary miniseries on his entry into the NFL, everything videotaped and edited and distilled down. Jack Beatty, here comes the first openly gay player into the NFL and reportedly coming with a little army of cameras following him in there. What do you think of the whole thing, Jack?
I wonder what would have happened if that would have been true in Jackie Robinson's day. It seems to me that the cameras guarantee a certain level of civility that may actually help him in his world. And as you use the word openly, and that's the key thing here. This has to be who knows how many players, but he can't be the only one. And it's heartening to see it happening. And I think maybe the word openly will be dropped in future years.
Well, at least at the margins, it's an open party of one here at the moment. But this is new turf being broken. A kiss celebrating drafting into the NFL. The first openly gay player, maybe Oprah's cameras to follow. We're on new terrain. I want to thank all three of you for being with us this week. Miriam Elder, foreign editor at BuzzFeed, thank you for joining us, Miriam.
Thank you.
John McCormick, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, thank you so much for being here, John.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks to you, as always.
Thank you.
9/11 Memorial Museum, opening in New York this week. We'll go out with the sound of the Young People's Chorus. They're performing Somewhere. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.